ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Thursday, the 6th of November. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. Housing is a hot issue in terms of affordability and availability. The Grattan Institute's put forward a radical idea today, saying if all cities relax their planning rules to allow three-storey buildings, an extra 67,000 homes would be delivered a year, potentially shaving $100,000 off the price of homes. More immediately, new figures from the federal government today show 1 in 10 first home buyers used the government's newly expanded home deposit scheme last month to buy a property. The program was expanded in October to allow all first home buyers to access it. And coincidentally, national house prices also grew at their fastest rate in more than 2 years. So the two connected? Here's Samantha Dick.
The federal government's expanded 5% home deposit scheme has faced its first test, and Housing Minister Claire O'Neill says all signs are positive.
What these numbers tell us is that this program is working.
New government figures show about 1 in 10 home buyers last month used Labor's program to break into the property market.
It's making a big difference to the young people who need our help, but only bringing a moderate number of new buyers into the market in this first month. That tells us it's not having a significant impact on house prices.
Under the expanded scheme, any first-home buyer can purchase with only a 5% deposit without having to pay lenders mortgage insurance, as the loan is underwritten by the government. More than 5,700 homes were purchased using the scheme in October, the first month that all Australians, regardless of income, were eligible. While the scheme is helping first-home buyers in the short term, the opposition argues it's stoking the flames of Australia's housing crisis, pointing to new data from research firm Cotality, which showed national house prices in October surged at their fastest rate in more than 2 years. But Eliza Owen, the head of Research Australia at Cotality, says there are much bigger forces at play.
It's hard to pinpoint exactly what has driven a stronger growth rate through October. Yes, it coincides with the expansion of the deposit scheme, but we have to remember seasonally in spring, you get a bit of a bump. We've also seen a reduction in interest rates, which increases credit availability to spend on housing, and supply levels are low. So that tends to increase competition and push prices higher as well.
The Grattan Institute's Housing and Economic Security Program Director, Brendan Coates, says the 5% deposit scheme may initially increase demand, but overall, the impact on prices would be modest.
In the shorter term, it is likely to bring forward some demand from people who are busy saving a 20% deposit that all of a sudden realise they don't need to and they can buy now. So the price effect will be slightly larger in the short term, but it's going to be pretty modest over the long term.
The renewed focus on housing policy comes as a report from the Grattan Institute suggests housing would become more affordable if more Australian cities embraced medium-density living. The think tank argues that allowing three-storey unit blocks to be built all over Australian cities would save renters $1,800 a year and shave $100,000 off the median price for a home. Mr. Coates says governments need to make it easier to build affordable homes where people want to live instead of pushing young people out of the middle suburbs.
Allowing three-storey townhouses and apartments across all residentially zoned land in our major cities would substantially boost the amount of housing that is built and that would be affordable for younger Australians in our capital cities, including more than 1 million extra homes in Sydney alone.
The report suggests the proposed reforms would add an extra 67,000 homes a year over the next decade.
Samantha Dick reporting there. Many would-be homeowners feel duped by real estate agents. Some claim agents are baiting them into attending auctions with property price guides well below the expected sale price. It's called price baiting. Julia Bergen prepared this report.
Well, buyers, we've got an incredible opportunity here today in Punchbowl. Obviously, you see a home like this immediately...
It's Saturday morning, raining, and no one's offering an opening bid for the three-bedroom home in Sydney's West.
I would have thought somewhere around 1.1 to 1.2, if you like, up to you.
Online, the property was advertised with a guide price of $1 million. At auction, the ABC was quoted 1.2, but the seller wanted over 1.3. And that's what they got, 30% above the advertised guide price.
1,318,000, we call it away. First, second, third time, put your hands together, welcome them to the neighbourhood. Oh, well done.
It's a similar story across many neighbourhoods in Sydney's west and inner west, and it's putting off buyers.
I don't trust car salesmen and real estate agents.
I'll tell you anything to get you here, but once you get here, it's a totally different story.
The large gap between expected price and sale price is sometimes due to healthy competition between buyers, but it's also because selling agents create the illusion of competition. That practice is called underquoting or price baiting. It's illegal, and in New South Wales, it's rife.
I understand why some agents would do this, and that is because when one agent does it, then you're then competing with that agent.
That's a selling agent in Sydney's inner west who spoke to the ABC on the condition of anonymity.
It actually comes down to the vendor agreeing to it because they know that they have to compete with the property down the road that is being underquoted. So that's where the pressure comes from.
The selling agent says it's just a few bad apples, but property data tells a different story. Web app creator Henry Pedersen, who's been tracking the pricing journey on every Australian property that goes to market, says he's found over 220 individual agents whose guide prices average more than 10% under the property's final sale price. Of those, almost 60% are in New South Wales, mostly Sydney's west and inner west.
The true issue when you look at it is just when a particular agent or area are consistently for multiple months and multiple transactions over, let's say, about 10%, because that clearly indicates that there's a broader issue.
While selling agents are setting the price, many buyer's agents are playing along. Frank Rousseau is a Sydney-based buyer's agent. He says price setting is all about framing.
I respect that. The selling agent's working for the owner, trying to get them the highest price. They're not working for the general public, trying to give them the most accurate information.
Knowing that, Frank Rousseau says buyers need to read up and do their own research to avoid making, quote, poor financial decisions. In a written statement, New South Wales Fair Trading Minister Anilak Chanthavong says the practice is unlawful, bad for buyers, and harms the industry. The Minister for Fair Trading says the government has established a multi-million dollar task force to tackle the problem and plans to announce more reforms soon.
Julia Bergen there. The family of an Australian man potentially facing the death penalty in Indonesia say it's devastated over his possible fate. Lamar Archie was arrested in Bali earlier this year over alleged cocaine smuggling. He denies any involvement. His family has spoken exclusively with the ABC ahead of his verdict and sentencing. Indonesia correspondent Tim Swanston filed this report from Bali.
Hugging his mother and sister and surrounded by cameras, North Queensland man Lamar Archie had a brief moment with his family on Tuesday at Bali's district court before returning to Korobokan prison. He's on trial for alleged drug smuggling. Police allege the 42-year-old organised for 1.7 kilograms of cocaine to be delivered to his North Kuta apartment earlier this year. In their first interview since his arrest, Mr. Archie's family have spoken about how devastated they were to receive the phone call that he'd been taken in by Indonesian authorities. Here's Stephanie Archie, Mr. Archie's sister.
Instantly you just feel sad, and we were crying, and yeah. And I guess for mum it was the most shocking, and my dad.
Mr. Archie was arrested in May. Indonesian police allege the cocaine that was delivered to him was concealed across more than 200 Lindt chocolate wrappers. He was paraded in front of the media in an orange jumpsuit and wearing a black mask.
I think the call was, like, shocking, but seeing him all over the news with the balaclava on was devastating. And, you know, my mum actually collapsed. Like, it was just so shocking.
Mr. Archie is on trial for several drugs offences. If found guilty of the most serious of those, he could face the death penalty. That's a prospect that's horrifying to his family.
There's so many people that love him. Like, I have so much respect for Bali and the legal process and all that stuff. I understand they're, you know, protecting their country and things like that, but he's such a good person, and he, for me, just got caught up in the wrong crowd.
At the trial, Mr. Archie told the court he didn't know cocaine was in the packages that were delivered to him, and he had them delivered as a favour to a friend. Legal experts in Indonesia say it's unlikely he'll be sentenced to the death penalty, and anecdotally, sentences for foreign nationals have appeared to be lighter. Indonesia hasn't carried out an execution of a prisoner on death row since 2016. Changes to the criminal code here would allow prisoners on death row a pathway out after 10 years of good behaviour. Here's Miss Archie again.
And I just don't feel like the death penalty is, I don't know, if you look at, you know, ethically, it just doesn't make sense for me, but I know other people out there have different opinions and that's fine, but yeah, to think that I could lose my brother in that way, yeah.
Mr. Archie is awaiting a verdict and sentencing expected later this month. This is Tim Swanston in Bali reporting for AM.
To the war in Ukraine, and Russia's boosted its efforts to secure the strategic city of Pokrovsk. Some military analysts estimate the Kremlin's deployed about 100,000 troops in its attempt to take the important transport and logistics hub, which could help it secure Ukraine's industrial Donbass region, one of the key Russian aims in this war. Europe correspondent Catherine Diss reports.
In a video released by Ukraine's special forces, the intensity of this battle laid bare. The soldier filming yells out, "Let's run this way into the dugout." Then he fires off three rounds towards the enemy. The propaganda video is designed to show Ukraine's still in this fight, despite reports the city of Pokrovsk is about to fall to Kremlin forces. Orisa Lutsevich is a military analyst from Chatham House. She says Russia is believed to have deployed close to 100,000 troops to the area.
It's a quite intense and vicious land war over there. They are deploying these forward groups that are trying to stabilize their position in the city and to wait for reinforcements. It will be an urban warfare.
Moscow's been trying to take the city for about 18 months, but Ukrainian forces have so far kept them at bay. There's little left of the city, which was once home to 60,000 people. Most have fled. Police are now evacuating the few that remain near this fierce front line. As hopes of holding the city fade, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky this week flew in to rally the troops.
The Russian army has once again been forced to push back the deadlines it had drawn up for itself for capturing Pokrovsk and Dobrobilia. And every Russian loss contributes to our ability to defend our state, our people, our independence.
While his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, instructed officials to look into whether they should resume nuclear testing in the wake of President Donald Trump suggesting the same.
I instruct the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, the Ministry of Defence of the Russian Federation, Special Services and the relevant civilian agencies to do everything possible to gather additional information on this matter, analyse it within the Security Council and submit coordinated proposals on the possible commencement of preparations for nuclear weapons tests.
If Moscow captures the city, it would be its largest territorial gain in close to 2 years and open up access to the rest of the strategically important industrial Donbass region, one of Russia's key aims when starting this almost four-year-old war. This is Catherine Deese in London, reporting for AM.
Australians put a high value on mental health, but most of us aren't engaged with issues surrounding mental health care. Research out today has grouped Australians into five categories, showing the varying attitudes towards mental health, how they think the system is functioning, and whether it matters to them. Angus Randall reports.
Stuart Baker hadn't given much thought to his mental health until his teenage daughter Mary had her own battle.
I think for the first time we experienced poor mental health in our family, and we hadn't encountered it before. And it was a real struggle because Mary had an eating disorder.
Mary was 15 years old when she died by suicide in 2011. Stuart Baker says there was a lot of sympathy but not much understanding.
Eating disorders weren't even considered to be a mental health problem by a lot of the community at that point. So it was a real struggle, and unfortunately we weren't able to save her.
A new report by Australians for Mental Health has taken a look at attitudes toward mental health and grouped people into five categories based on their views, ranging from those educated and engaged about mental health support to those who don't really think about it, all the way to the 15% who believe descriptions of a mental health crisis have been exaggerated. Dr. Rebecca Huntley is the Director of Research at 89 Degrees East, which carried out the survey.
Did they feel that we were in a mental health crisis, and who did they think was responsible? Did they think it was mental health was something that, you know, individuals were responsible for, in a sense of you kind of can choose to be mentally healthy or not? Were they optimistic about us addressing the mental health challenges we face?
It found Australians place a high value on mental health. 80% say it's as important to the nation's well-being as the economy and education. The study then drilled down into how engaged people were about mental health and whether they thought enough was being done.
At the kind of one end of the spectrum, you've got the empowered optimists who think that mental health is incredibly important, but they themselves think the system is working. If you can find help, you know, it's not that hard. You get other groups like the discouraged battlers that think, yes, there is a mental health crisis, and in fact, it's very hard to get help. The best communications campaigns and education campaigns in the world aren't going to make that group think, well, you know, suddenly it's going to be easier for me.
The largest group, 27% of respondents, are called the conditional sympathisers. They recognised mental health as a major issue, but are unlikely to have actually engaged with the system, and it's not a priority for them. Australians for Mental Health Executive Director Chris Gambian says the research will help tailor programs based on people's attitudes.
One size just doesn't fit all, so this is going to be a brilliant tool to help us, to help government, to help service providers, to help all sorts of organisations, companies, talk to the Australian people about mental health in a way that works so that we can start to really engage properly.
That's Chris Gambian, the Executive Director of Australians for Mental Health, ending Angus Randall's report. The Great Barrier Reef will suffer a rapid decline, with less than 20% of it covered in coral by the end of this century if global temperatures rise by more than 2 degrees. It's according to new modelling by Queensland marine researchers, who say they've also proven coral can adapt to hotter temperatures. It may not happen, though, in our lifetimes. Joanna Carruthers reports.
It's been a good day out on the water for Master Reef Guide Tarn Miller.
Had a fantastic day with beautiful conditions, low winds out on the Opal Reef.
The reef is about 55 kilometres east of Port Douglas, where Tarn has worked as a guide and tourism operator for 15 years. Despite a good season of coral on display and high visitor numbers, the delicate nature of the ecosystem is always on his mind.
So, you know, it's maybe too early to predict a bleaching event, but there's definitely early signs of stress heading into this summer season.
In his time on the reef, he's seen 6 mass coral bleaching events and the impacts of multiple cyclones. But he doesn't believe the reef has been pushed beyond a tipping point.
The Great Barrier Reef is still great. Have we lost tremendous amounts of coral cover? I say yes. But we have enough biomass here on the Great Barrier Reef that it is resilient enough to just continually keep coming back.
New modelling on the reef's future from the University of Queensland shows that coral's capacity to recover depends on how much warmer the ocean becomes over this century. The research team replicated climate scenarios that coral would have to live in based on a number of global emissions trajectories. If the planet meets the target of less than 2 degrees of warming under the Paris Agreement, the reef has a much better chance of adapting. Marine ecologist Professor Peter Mumby led the study, partially funded by the federal government.
If we can move the needle upwards and achieve the Paris Agreement, that's a much, much better future for coral reefs of the Great Barrier Reef. If, on the other hand, we allow our emissions to increase, it's then that we can't foresee a future.
The model simulated the life cycles of different coral species on around 3,800 individual reefs and found a rapid decline over the next few decades was all but inevitable. But exactly how warm it gets has a massive impact on what happens after that.
What will really change is what happens in 2050 to the end of the century. And if we can get ourselves on this better pathway from emissions, then reefs will be able to help themselves cope with that stress, and we will have moderate reefs, recognisable reefs at least.
Dive master Tarn Miller says it's important he spreads the message that the reef still has much to offer.
I've seen incredible recovery every time I see an amazing patch of coral, just to video it and just put it out in the public space.
Both Labor and the Coalition have previously committed to the Paris Climate Accord. However, earlier this week, the Nationals abandoned the commitment to reach net zero emissions by 2050.
Joanna Carruthers there. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. It's a dark cloud that's hovered over her Liberal Party leadership since the beginning. And now the Nationals have officially canned net zero. The pressure is on for Susan Lee to do the same. Today, Chief Political Correspondent at The Conversation, Michelle Grattan, on whether Australian voters are willing to give up on the key emission reduction target. Look for the ABC News Daily Podcast on the ABC Listen app.